Welcome to Resounds, Arts and Culture on the High Plains. I'm Corby Skinner.
And I'm Jennifer Corning, and we're sharing stories of creative people who live and work in the Intermountain West. The experiences and memories of living in rural country and wilderness are recollected on the page by poets Corey Williamson and Joe Wilkins. Their newest books of poetry capture many of the sensations, dangers, labors, and echoes of country life. Corey Williamson was born and reared on a small farm in southwestern Virginia and now makes her home in central Montana. Today, we will learn more about her newest book of poems, Your Mother's Bear Gun. She has authored two previous poetry collections, The River Where You Forgot My Name and Sweet Husk, both award-winning books. Also with us is Joe Wilkins. He was raised on a sheep ranch north of the Bow Mountains. His thoughts on rural identity, family, the environment, and masculinity are explored through verse. Joe is a novelist, essayist, and poet. He authored the novel Fall Back Down When I Die, the winner of the 2020 High Plains Book Award. His newest book is Pastoral 1994.
Corey and Joe, welcome to Resounds at Yellowstone Public Radio. Jennifer and I had the pleasure of hearing you read last night, but now we want to share this with our audience on the radio. So first, congratulations on having books published.
Thank you.
Always kind of a lot of work to get anything published
these days.
Mm-hmm. Both your books look at country life and the relationship to land. Let's start there. Tell us about that dynamic of that. Corey, you talked about it quite a bit last night, too. Do you want to start?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, last night we had a great question about landscape and the role of landscape in writing and poetry and, you know, I think Joe and I both talked about having grown up in rural settings. I grew up on a small farm in the foothills of the Appalachians and now live in Montana and have always been drawn to open landscapes and sort of wilderness areas. And a lot of this book was written when I was living deep in the wilderness in southwestern Oregon along the Rogue River. And I had a very unique fellowship, essentially. It was the Boyden Wilderness Writing Residency, which is an opportunity for one writer each year to experience extraordinary solitude, far from anything, 2 hours to the nearest town, no cell phone service, no Wi-Fi, just a little radio phone that worked 60% of the time. So I lived there for 8 months in 2020 at the height of the pandemic, and it really rewired my brain, I think, when I look back on it and changed the way that I interact with the landscape, because that was essentially all I interacted with for many months. And it made me think slower. It made me observe and process in a different way. It made me feel both connected to and disconnected from, you know, the things around me. And it made me think a lot about safety and danger and the way natural environments, you know, ask us to sort of step into different environments of safety.
And then also your parents and sister are very much a part of your poetry. Does having the time to think about that help create poems?
Yes, for sure. And I think my experience has always been that sometimes something happens and I want to process it through poetry immediately. And sometimes life happens and you need to get years and years between you and the memory or you and certain experiences to be able to write about it, or you need a certain kind of space or kind of mental room to be able to approach certain things. So there are a lot of poems about my family, particularly my sister, who also kind of lives in a very rural wilderness environment. She lives in a little tiny 8x16 foot shed in the mountains in Virginia, totally off the grid as well. And so there was an interesting kind of conversation happening for me in my wilderness in Oregon on my side of the country and thinking about my sister in hers and the way also I learned to experience and love and try to care for the landscape growing up in the Appalachians.
Well, I think it's time, Corey. Oh. Why don't we share a poem with our listeners?
Okay. How about, I'll read one about my sister and her neck of the woods, since we were talking about that. This poem mentions a natural phenomenon called mast fruiting, which is where wild trees, like wild fruit trees or wild nut trees, will sometimes go years without much of a crop, without like a significant, you know, bloom or crop yield. And then all of a sudden in a county or region or whole bioregion, they'll all like produce madly all at once together. And we really have no explanation for why that happens. So this poem mentions that. It's called To My Sister on the Matter of Trees. Our father takes a chainsaw to the dropped oak, and it becomes a cord, beautiful word for the life we burn. That old wood stove goes on warming the living room from below. Look close, and there's still no denying the ache of adding ring upon ring, years of drought or plenty turned to heartwood and core. This winter, my brain shuddered under snow, believing for the first time in the night in my own turning to smoke, lapis twist and curl above the house, a breath, ascent, dissolution. Spring, and I wait, ropey, unsure when to unspool, like the currents of sweetness the maples weep on your land. You write to say, I buried a squirrel drowned in the sap bucket. I write to say, I cannot get right the poem about the man chopping wood, how our days rise, cleave, fall away. You tell me then that after 5 years on 30 acres covered in black walnut forest with no harvest to speak of, you cut the largest tree at the top of the hill. The following autumn, the rest rained down in abundance their green husked fists of seed.
Lovely.
Thank you.
Joe, you are an essayist, a novelist, and a poet. And I'm kind of interested in your approach to poetry. Your poems are fairly short, brief. And Jennifer said to me the poem about the Bob Wire scars was so personal she ached hearing it and reading from it and remembering old wounds herself. Who are you writing for? Mm. Are you getting your story out, or are you looking for the audience?
You know, as a young writer, I think I was writing madly and feverishly for myself, to try to understand the things that wouldn't leave me alone, the things I couldn't stop thinking about, the places I couldn't stop thinking about. And so in some ways, it was just sort of like trying to hold on to the fire hose as it's spraying around and you know, do something with it. As I've grown as a writer, I'm more and more aware of, as you say, the different genres where the stories end up in prose. Now the poems have gotten shorter, tighter, more lyrical. And I'm often thinking with the poems anymore, they've sort of stepped outside of me in a way. And I'm writing often to my grandfather. I'm writing to my mom. I'm writing to try to understand their experiences and the place I grew up alongside my own, but in again, as a young writer, it was much more about me. Now, I feel like there's a sense of a community when I'm writing poems, a sense of trying to look from different angles and perspectives.
I've never liked collected poems, anthologies of collective. It just is too much going on.
Yeah.
And both of your books are very personal, but they're contained, too.
Yeah.
It seems that the book of poetry is a whole unit, and they kind of relate to each other. Would that be correct?
Our books, I absolutely think they relate to each other. We both were just lucky that the press picked these books together. We'd known each other as poets and as fellow Rogue River writer residents. And the fact that they picked these books together, I think, was I mean, just a wonderful blessing. And then reading them, I'd been reading some of these poems out in the world, but then reading Corey's poems collected, I was just like, oh yes, there's so much going on between these two books. They're very much in conversation. Yeah.
And I think within the books themselves, like these are both, and maybe this is part of why our editors were kind of drawn to these books together, right, is they are pretty contained within a narrative or a time frame, right? Like, you know, Joe is very sort of reflective on his youth and growing up and the particular environment. And my book, too, is also very interested in not the same environment throughout the book, but kind of the same situations of engaging with wilderness and sort of pulling together some really common themes and threads. So I think you're encountering that, too, in these books, is that they are kind of capsules of geographies or moments or landscapes.
Last night at the reading, the audience was primarily academics, other poets, a couple of students, but I actually sat next to someone that we both know who was a rural rancher. What's your experience reading your work to the people that propagate the poems themselves?
That's a great question. I'm trying to think the last time. I mean, it was wonderful to see Bill Milton in the audience last night.
It's great to have Bill.
Yeah. I will say this summer when I came through to read here in Billings for my latest novel, The Entire Sky, we were over at the Western Heritage Center, and it was full of people, a few people I knew, but quite a few people I didn't know, and a lot of folks that for lack of a better word, looked rural. Lots of cowboy hats and Wranglers and some Carhartts and some shirts that had seen the outside. And an old fellow came up to me and he said, "Someone told me there was a poet out in the Bull Mountains." I said, "There's no poets out in the Bull Mountains." Well, I guess I was wrong. And so that was quite the compliment, I thought.
I always say it's harder to read poems in front of people I know than in front of complete strangers. And it was very emotional for me to, you know, send this book to my family. And they know, they're used to it. You know, this is my third book, and they always say, "Be careful what you say in front of Corey, because it'll end up in a book." But yeah, I mean, this book deals a lot with childhood recollections and also tensions. And there's a lot in this book that's kind of reckoning with the gun culture I grew up in, with the sort of philosophy that my father had and has about guns and about self-protection and self-preservation, which is a theme in this book. And so all the poems here are very loving, but they are also helping me process my own complex feelings. And so it's a little bit terrifying to bring those to the people who planted those seeds. I am very lucky that my family received this and all my work with grace and love, but I know not all writers are that lucky, and I always sort of pause and I'm thankful for that.
Which reminds me, Corey, your poem about the gun is so wonderful because it talks about what the gun meant to somebody and what it means to you as a contemporary, as a woman, and it was really beautifully thought out.
Thank you.
Joe, your poem about lambing season made me think, both about your youth growing up and a certain level of nostalgia. Mm-hmm. Do you have that poem that you could read us?
Yes, absolutely. Husbandry. The first lamb comes clean and easy, comes wool-ribbed and wet. And the second, smaller, pinker, has the curved, limp look of a fish in my grandfather's hands, in my hands as I hook the caul from its nose and gentle it next to its mother, the old ewe licking one lamb and then the other and huffing proudly, motherly, as each lamb bleats feebly, that nodding stalk of newborn neck. And I stand, the ache of midnight in my knees, behind my eyes, when, crack, the ewe flings her head back, grinds her wide eye and wild tongue in the dirt and straw, the whole of her rocked, wrung. And my grandfather is reaching in, is trying with only his hands to hold back the meaty rush of prolapse. Hell, he says, hell and goddamn. And I'm standing there dumb, standing 1,000 miles and 30 years later at the kitchen sink, my own hands disappeared in the dishwater.
Which reminds me, that scene shows up again in your latest novel, The Entire Sky, when that young city boy is with the older rancher, they're having to lamb, and the kid is just devastated and amazed and excited. So
And I think, I mean, yes, I was writing these books somewhat at the same time. And so a lot of those things were coming to me, and sometimes it was coming to me in the form of story and sometimes in the form of these moments in time. And, you know, I think we're all still that kid, and I'm still that kid helping my grandfather lamb even now as a grown person. And I often think, and maybe this circles back to your first question, Corby, but the lessons that farm life and rural life taught me about care and about husbandry, about husbanding and tending to things, were so deep and still serve me well as a father to teenagers. And it also taught me great lessons about death and how things can go mightily wrong so quickly, and how we then have to do the best we can with what's available to us. And those are lessons, too, I've tried to continue to learn and bring into my world.
I'll be honest that I prefer the novel to poetry. I actually enjoy a poetry reading, but I don't necessarily read poetry that much. And Joe, Fall Back Down When I Die might be one of my favorite books. It's just so wonderful. How do you move from the novel to the poem, and what's your approach to those two different media?
Yeah. For me, the poem is all about language. It's about trying, as Corey says, trying to figure something out with the language, trying to see if the language can illuminate something. Answer question isn't quite right, but like move a little further into something and see if the language won't help me understand or help me see and know and feel about something a little bit more fully, a little bit more wisely. And it often, again, for me, is a moment in time. It doesn't move through time. It's here and then it's gone. It's a quick flash, the shooting star. And the prose, the stories come to me through time. They come to me with all the complications time allows, and the textures and the ways we are moving forward and backward and circling and struggling. And so the stories come to me in that way, sort of this forward motion versus this quick, bright flash.
And Corey, I didn't know, but Jennifer told me she saw one of your poems online. And I'm very interested. I will actually look that up.
One of the YouTube readings, yes.
But how is that experience? Does that tell the audience something more than if they were to read it or to hear you read it? What is that visual element, or how does that add to the story?
It depends, I think. I mean, you know, you heard me last night. I like to tell stories about poems in person. You know, I think that the book is a very quiet contract with the reader, and once you put poems in a book, you have very little control over how they experience that or move through it. But when you're in a room with somebody, you can say more, right? You can offer a little bit of context that they might not have had. You can make something funnier. You can make something richer. You can share something. I mean, I share a lot of personal things in poems, but when I'm with people, I like to just sort of like pull back the curtain a little bit. And not all poets do that. I mean, I've seen plenty of readings where poets just read their poems and they, you know, they might not even be there with you for all you know. And that's fine too. And I have certainly been to poetry readings where I've heard poets read a poem I love and spoil it for me, you know, and I've been to a reading where I've heard a poet read a poem that I was not particularly excited by and it blew me away. So it does create that true personal connection, right? A poem is a form of connection. A poem is an exercise in empathy. But when you're there offering the poem, I think you can kind of choose how you do that. And I really enjoy that. I really like being present in the room and making myself sort of part of what I'm offering to a reader or a listener.
Maybe we should have you read that poem, Meditation.
Meditation? Okay. Well, since we're talking about context, I'll just say that this poem is about me trying to meditate in the wilderness. And it references the metta meditation, which is kind of a classic Buddhist meditation where you wish all beings health and wellness. You say over and over, may all beings be well, may all beings be safe, and that kind of thing. And this was something I tried to train my mind to do living alone in the woods, and it was always challenging to keep the monkey mind focused or not get drawn away by other needs or demands, which this poem references as well. Meditation. Quiet, I say to the mind, and the mind says, frog song, bear emergence, death of all salmon kind, local proliferation of buried nuclear silos, tomorrow's breakfast, blossom riot of bees in pollen tresses, a child reaching into a sleek, unlocked gun safe. May all beings be safe, I go on, and the mind hears only scriffle scutter of mice in the insulation. May all beings be well, I insist, and the mind pries open the eye to see one like a fat suede knuckle, paw tucked, slinking behind the stove, along the corner and out of sight. May all beings know contentment in hard times. The mind reminds me that mice are thigmotactic and hug a wall like a mother's hip. Ah, little cannonball of knowing. May all beings know peace, I say, but the mind already is planning where to put the poison.
It's sort of like you would think because you're alone and have all that time, it would be easy to meditate.
You would think that. You try it, Corby.
One might think that, yeah.
And so is not the case. I am going to, you could be thinking about this, because yeah. I want each of you to read the other's poem, mm-hmm. your favorite poem. But first, tell me about... River Books. Is it River Books?
River yeah. River Books.
And the connection to the publisher, and how did you have a connection with that publisher before, or how did they find you?
They are a rather new press. I think they've only been around a couple years. And in the poetry world, you send out a lot of things, and then you get a lot of rejections back. And every once in a while, you get the good news that someone wants to publish something. And so when I had completed this manuscript, I was looking around for who had open submissions and which presses were publishing books I was excited about. And I found them and I thought, I hadn't even heard of them. And so I sent the book in, and then a few months later was really excited when I learned that it was one of the ones they were going to publish. Mm-hmm. I had known one of the editors just in passing. I'd been introduced to him once, and he's quite a poet. And I had not known the other editor at all, and now I'm reading her work, and it's astonishingly good. But, yeah, Corey.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is my third book, and each one has been with a different press. And my first press was Perugia, which is this really incredible, tiny press based out of Massachusetts, and they publish one book a year by a woman, and it's her first or second book. And they are like a family to me. Like, I still feel like I am a Perugia Press sister. And every time I have a new book, every time I have a new poem, you know, they will share this interview. Like, they just celebrate all their writers' work. And I loved that, even though that was a really, you know, tiny little press compared to some. And then my second book was with a big university press. And that was great. That was a good experience. And I was delighted when that publication was accepted, and I was like, oh, this, you know, this feels maybe more prestigious. But at the same time, when you become part of a big university catalog, you're just part of the catalog, and I don't hear from those folks anymore, and they don't celebrate my wins, and that's okay. That's kind of how the publishing world works. But so for this book, I was like, I want to be like in the family again. Like, I want to find a small press whose work I like, who's going to really take a ton of time and care with my book and love it forever and promote it and me forever. Because, you know, poetry doesn't sell a ton of books. You don't make a ton of money from poetry. So, like, why not have a publisher that's just going to, like, love on you and praise you forever? And so when I kind of encountered River River as a press, I was like, ooh, this feels like what I'm looking for. And then I was obviously thrilled when they published it, and then they were like, oh, and our other book is Joe Wilkins. And I was like, you are kidding me.
Well, congratulations to both of you, and bravo for the press.
Yeah.
Let's finish. And Joe, do you have a poem of Corey's that you'd like to read?
I'll read this poem, which Corey referenced the title last night, which I think is just a stunning title. And I think, again, goes back to the beginning of our conversation about the ways in which landscape and place are sort of some of those first movers, you know, the old word kith. We think of it as relations or friends, but it used to mean your local acre, the place that you all called home, the place that you built community on, that sort of allowed you. And so this poem is all forms of landscape are autobiographical. A wing breaks the monotony of endless highway. A wing the length of an 18-wheeler, white as a peeled boiled egg. A wing that will harness wind and slice the flight from birds who meet it. Who knows where the soul goes after the light switch is turned off, Wright said. I had a lover who, not because he was a poet, but because he'd seen too much shit in Iraq, called death getting switched off. God at the switchboard, God bored by the confluence of electric wires, red or blue. He inquires, pretending not to know. Out here, the snow drifts could be sand, the endless unseen flyways of birds, oxbow and warp like a stream in the cirrus wisps, but could be the cracks in a dry arroyo's bed. My truck's shadow rolls along the wheat field's glow, a gyre falcon, resident till spring, cocks its silver face as I pass. The sun goes down behind the grumble of trains, its pastel fire flashing in the joints between coal cars. I don't know what happened to that man, only that he swore his life was saved by snow in the Bridgers and the Missouri River's green bounty of light and trout, his line switching the sky.
Very nice. It must be fun having somebody else read your
poem.
That
was so delightful, actually. Gosh,
so thank
Corey, you,
Joe. So, Corey, it's your turn to read one of Joe's.
Okay. I'm going to read Locust. And I love this poem, and I think both of our books have this kind of interest in what is the natural world just doing, and how do we perceive it as good, or how do we perceive it as helpful, or how do we perceive it as violent, and how do we maybe enact violence back upon it? And I'm also just really fascinated by locusts. Locust. Nothing came up in the north field. We haven't seen rain since April. The clouds above weigh many tons. They drift by like sedans on the highway. My grandfather says there used to be a song like this, the kind you play on a mouth harp, better than a dozen verses, half again as many choruses. No matter how it goes, the devil shows up. He's like grasshoppers that way. I'll keep a glass jar of them on my bedstand. I like in the night their click and skitter. I dream a lake as blue as my rifle eye. If you hook them at the thorax, they'll twitch for hours, even with a sinker, even at the very bottom.
Joe Wilkins and Corey Williamson, thank you so much for being in the studio. We'll have more information about your books on our website so people can check out that. And thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to Resounds, Arts and Culture on the High Plains, produced by Corby Skinner, Jennifer Corning, and Ken Siebert for Yellowstone Public Radio. Theme music by Alex Nauman. Hear this program anytime online at ypradio.org.